Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA senior reporter Mohamed El-Shenawy. Our topic on this edition of the program, Egypt Votes. Our guest, Paul Salem. He's Vice President for Policy and Research at the Middle East Institute, or MEI. That's a nonpartisan policy group based here in Washington. Prior to joining MEI, Paul Salem was the founding director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut, Lebanon, between 2006 and 2013. Egyptians went to the polls last week to elect a new president, in which the only truly viable candidate was former defense minister and army chief Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Leftist politician Hamdine Sabahi was the only other candidate on the ballot besides al-Sisi. But turnout was so low on the first of the two-day election that Egypt's government extended voting for a third day, this after having declared the second day a national holiday in a bid to increase participation. A high turnout is seen as key to legitimizing Sisi's long-assumed win in a process that began when he led the army's ouster of former President Mohamed Morsi last July. Mr. Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood had urged Egyptians to boycott the vote and said in a statement last week that Sisi and his allies will not be able to legitimize their actions with, quote, more fraud and tricks. Egypt has seen 3 years of political turmoil since the popular uprising that pushed former leader Hosni Mubarak from power in early 2011. Mr. Morsi became Egypt's first democratically elected president in 2012, but he lasted only a year in office before protesters held mass rallies accusing him of trying to monopolize power and failing to fix Egypt's economy. His ouster set off protests from the Muslim Brotherhood and a violent military crackdown that left more than 1,000 people dead. Many of the Brotherhood's leaders have also been arrested, and Sisi says the Islamist group has no future in Egypt. An army-backed interim government has been overseeing a roadmap for a new constitution and elections for president and parliament. Voters overwhelmingly approved a referendum on the constitution in January, and the vote for parliament is expected later this year. Analysts say that the challenges ahead for Egypt are monumental. Egypt teeters on the brink of a solvency crisis. It has a highly polarized society, endures daily protests, experiences frequent terrorist attacks, and relentlessly cracks down on most forms of dissent. So will the election of a new president usher in a period of greater security, prosperity, and good governance, or a continuation of uncertainty and volatility in Egyptian politics and economic life? We'll talk with Paul Salem, a longtime observer of Egypt and the Middle East, for his analysis. And Paul Salem joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
And always delighted to welcome Mohamed El-Shenawy.
Thank you.
Well, Paul Salem, we note the extension of voting, low turnout. Some analysts are saying that this extension of voting looks like a desperate measure to try to legitimize al-Sisi's candidacy and more than expected win. You said in a recent article that numbers do matter. What are we seeing?
Indeed, numbers do matter. It was quite clear that between the two candidates, Field Marshal Sisi and Mr. Hamdine Sabahi, that Sisi certainly has the majority of those who will show up to vote. The key questions were, what would the voter turnout be, and how many voters would vote for Mr. Sisi? The numbers in the recent past are important to keep in mind. The active voting population who showed up in the very highly contested 2012 elections were about 26 million voters. That's about 52% of the eligible voters of Egypt. So that's kind of a measure, if most parties are engaged, about how many people normally should show up. In the referendum that was held in January of this year, which proposed the new constitution, the post-Muslim Brotherhood constitution, it was also sort of seen as a referendum on the new order, on the removal of Morsi in general terms. The numbers declared then were about 20 million, which is a fairly significant number. Now, Sisi, in a speech last week, said he wanted 40 million votes, which indicates that he either is not up on his numbers, because that is not a number that in any realistic scenario he could have gotten. I do think if he gets something close to the 20 million, that would be a result that would more or less satisfy his supporters. But given what we've seen during the days of elections, it seems that the voter turnout is probably considerably lower than 20 million. It's also problematic that we're not sure that the numbers that will be announced will necessarily be the correct numbers.
Indeed. Well, let me get Mohamed El-Shanawi to weigh in.
What's your assessment of the impact of low turnout on Sisi's stature and legitimacy, both inside and outside Egypt?
I think it would be a big blow to his stature, to his mandate, and it would require, I think, a rethink of how he will manage his presidency and how his supporters manage the process moving forward. He assumed an overwhelming mandate to him, and that he would then sort of carry that popular authority to manage the governance and economic policy of Egypt for the next few years with a strong public mandate. And he had support certainly from a lot of Gulf countries. Now, without a strong mandate, I think there will have to be a rethink. That might have to include consideration of how to form the next government, maybe include fresh faces, try to compensate for some of the weak results of the elections through politics, through government formation. It might require a fresh approach to the next elections, which are the parliamentary elections.
How about Sabahi? He is supported by all sorts of opposition figures and forces, including a wide spectrum of the angry youth that were not satisfied with going back to the army rule. Would that constitute a new political opposition that can be strong enough to establish a real democracy in Egypt in the years to come?
Well, I think it's a necessary and excellent element. I think Hamdine Sabahi did a great service to Egypt and to many people to keep the competition alive. He knew that he wasn't going to win, but I think both for him and many of his supporters, they recognize that they have to do a number of things. First, keep the principle of electoral competition alive. Second, build a coalition that can actually manage campaigns, that can put forward candidates, and that can contest politics, so that in the future, even if they don't win now, they can be players in the parliamentary elections, and maybe in a future presidential election, they could have a better chance. It's important to keep in mind, if you look back at the first round of the 2012 elections, in that first round, Hamdine Sabahi and Amr Moussa got about 9 or 10 million votes between them. And these are sort of the non-Islamic, non-government people. Had they united in one candidate in the first round, of course they would have gone to the second round, and of course they would have won the presidential election. That's certain. So the fact that the youth, the non-Islamists, the so-called liberals, the democratic forces, the fact that they are not able to organize and unite has done a great disservice to Egypt, has given an opportunity previously to the Muslim Brotherhood, which really wasn't the majoritarian choice initially of the Egyptians, or given a chance to the army to step in and fill the void. But there is a void, and I think Hamdine has done a great job, done what he can do to start to fill that void. I think the fact that the idea of putting forward a military candidate has stumbled in a big way in this election should cause those in the military and maybe supporters abroad to rethink this strategy and to recognize that at the end of the day, Egypt really does need democracy, and it needs a competitive democracy among national, non-religious, and non-military parties, and cannot be governed like petro-states, whether in the Gulf or in Russia or elsewhere.
Paul Salem, that may be true that Egypt does need democracy. However, that does not seem to be a priority for el-Sisi. He said his platform consists primarily of security, stability, and economic development. And many Egyptians also have rallied around him because they are tired of what I've heard some say is too much democracy, which looks like chaos. I'm just paraphrasing. But because democracy is not the priority right now, it's more getting the economy back on track, stability. How do you see Sisi's platform and his ability to enact it? And what about the Muslim Brotherhood, who has boycotted the election? And what will become of them? This is a very polarized society.
Well, candidate Sisi is right that most Egyptians want security, stability, and prosperity. I think the error is how to get those things. And democracy is not an end in itself, and you can't eat democracy. But in a country like Egypt, which is a very large country, which is now a very politically aware country that's been through decades of authoritarian rule and rejected it, that tried a year of Islamic rule and rejected it, that is now sort of giving a tepid vote about a return to sort of authoritarian rule, an inclusive form of politics, the building of two or three national political parties that can assume executive power, is simply part of the necessary architecture of the future of Egypt. And Egypt, unfortunately, cannot have profound stability or long-lasting inclusive economic development with top-down politics. And the people don't accept it anymore. Maybe 30 years before, they did accept it, and you could have decent management and so on, and life could go on. But you could say the same thing about politics in the U.S. It's not the most efficient system. As Churchill said, democracy is a terrible system, but all the others are worse.
Indeed. We all hope that those who catalyzed the revolution back in February 2011, the youth, the April 6th movement, etc., will gain strength, organize. But we have to acknowledge the Muslim Brotherhood. Why does al-Sisi think that outlawing them, marginalizing them, leaving them no opportunity for a political voice, why that would actually promote stability and security?
Well, I think a number of mistakes have been committed, grievous ones, by both parties. First of all, the Egyptian state selected and supported the Muslim Brotherhood since the 70s, intentionally, from Sadat through Mubarak, in order to weaken other political parties, which were more vibrant and could contest political space much more effectively than a traditional Islamist sort of missionary movement. So the state is very much responsible for the condition that Egypt was left in when Mubarak was toppled. There was the state and the pet of the state, which was the Muslim Brotherhood for many years.
This is an excellent point.
Now, the Muslim Brotherhood, very proud to be a sort of proselytizing religious movement to make society more religious and more Islamic, and that's a right within society, as a religious movement. Now, when the Muslim Brotherhood chose to join the political process before and then after the revolution, it formed a party. But from that process on, they committed a number of grievous mistakes. First of all, there really wasn't a party that was independent from the movement. It really was guided by the movement, and all major decisions were made by the movement. The president that was elected, Mohamed Morsi, in effect, was neither really the leader of the party nor the leader of the movement. He worked within the movement, and that offended many Egyptians, that they elected somebody to be president of Egypt, and it wasn't really a party, it was more of a movement. And the party slash movement took their narrow electoral victory, and it was really narrow, and they were brought to power. I mean, they had about 5 million core votes, and they got 8 million more from other parties, because those other parties didn't want to vote for the state's candidate. They took that as a mandate for the Muslim Brotherhood to take over the state and take Egypt in a direction that the most Egyptians certainly did not want. I think the way forward is to reopen political space within clear rules and open them up for all parties that adhere to certain principles. I think it's also up to the Muslim Brotherhood to review what they did in their year in power towards their own public. That includes violations of constitutional, processes, a violation of sort of the revolution that brought them to power. And a lot of members or wings of the party did threaten and use violence and arms. Did they threaten the people? They threatened the state and so on. And that cannot have no place in politics either.
Quickly, before we turn to a break, Paul Salem, do you see evidence of this kind of soul-searching occurring within the Muslim Brotherhood and any possibility of some kind of a reconciliation, given the polarization between the groups, particularly the Muslim Brotherhood and the military?
Yeah, there is some soul-searching among some in the Brotherhood. Of course, many of the top leaders and leaders of the Brotherhood are in jail, so one doesn't have any access to them. There was a declaration that came out of Brussels recently from some former Brotherhood or Brotherhood people in exile who, you know, sort of extended an olive branch and set out terms for the beginning of a dialogue. I mean, there are a number of issues here. I think the bulk of the Muslim Brotherhood is still in the post-Mursi phase and wanting to put a lot of, you know, pressure on this Sisi period and so on. I imagine they're very happy with the low turnout in the election. I don't think they want to begin negotiating yet, but they've also been through this many times before. It's an old movement that's come to blows with the state many times before, and they will find a way back. I think candidate Sisi and probably President Sisi himself has made it clear that he will not, in his term in office, countenance any conciliation with the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, there might be a way around that to open up the political space. A new party might be formed. You know, there's always some ways, but I think it has to happen at some point. I don't think, unfortunately, it will happen very soon.
We'll have more in just a minute. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Paul Salem. He's vice president of the Middle East Institute. That's a think tank based here in Washington. We're talking about the fallout from the recent presidential elections in Egypt. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA senior reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And as always, we love to hear from you. Please send your feedback to PCUSA@voanews.com. And now a question from Mohammed.
Let's move forward to the relation between the United States and Egypt post-elections. In his latest foreign policy address, President Obama said, "In Egypt, we acknowledge that our relationship is anchored in security interests, from the peace treaty with Israel to shared efforts against violent extremism." Does that mean more of the same U.S. policy in post-election Egypt, or would it have a different policy option?
Well, I think President Obama has sort of made it clear in general, and it has become clear in his mandate, that he's neither an idealist nor a realist in foreign policy. I say not an idealist in the sense that he is not out to achieve some dream either of democracy or human rights or something like Jimmy Carter was, or even George W. Bush, who said, you know, at one point, you know, he wanted to establish democracies in the region. Despite his speech in Cairo 6 years ago and his speech in Turkey and so on, those speeches were intended to repair the bad relations that had emerged under Bush. But they did not represent an idealism that the Obama administration was going to invest in political change and democracy. And he's made it very clear that he doesn't think that currently that is the U.S. business. Secondly, he's not a realist in the sense that he's not playing geopolitics with Russia or, you know, with others in some old Cold War strategy. What he really is, I would say, almost a foreign policy minimalist. Obviously, his main concern is domestic politics. He's always made it clear from the very beginning that he thinks, as he says, nation building begins at home. He looks to foreign policy only in the sense that where might there be a direct threat or something that directly affects the United States, he will do something about it. And he has identified essentially three or four things in the Middle East that he thinks really impact the U.S. very much. One is terrorism and the war against terror. That's a high priority. Secondly, Israel as a super ally of the U.S. Anything that affects Israel is relevant to him. Thirdly, the free flow of oil from the Gulf. And fourthly, the Iranian nuclear program and hence now negotiations. Those are four things that he thinks the U.S. should be engaged in. Otherwise, he has said and he has shown that he will not do much about other issues. The only time he did think something other than that was in Libya, where he okayed that the U.S. military would get involved. But as his administration says, that effort was led by the Europeans. The U.S. helped out. Didn't intervene in Syria. He's not intervening and not really getting much involved in the politics of Egypt. He might have his own opinions, but he doesn't think that that is part of U.S. policy. And yes, he's made it clear that as far as his priorities, which is anti-terror and Israel, those two things, that relationship with the Egyptian military, not as a governor of Egypt, but as a military, those things are U.S. interests And he has made it clear that he will maintain those.
Okay, well then you just answered my question because of the 4 points, terrorism in Israel, both relate directly to Egypt.
To Egypt, yes.
And particularly with the militant groups in the Sinai starting to accelerate activities. How do you see those kinds of activities in the post-election scenario in Egypt? Do you see more Islamist militants attacking security forces? What do you think will be the fallout?
Well, it's hard to predict. I don't think there will be a direct fallout. It is a major challenge in Egypt, as it is in some other countries. It's not directly related necessarily to the politics of Cairo and Alexandria and the voters of Egypt. But Egypt certainly had already been facing a serious threat from the Libyan border and from the Gaza border. Al-Qaeda itself and its cohort groups have gained great momentum in Syria and Iraq. They feel that this is a second opportunity for them. And of course, many angry supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood or other Islamist movements now identify the Egyptian government as a target, especially as led by candidate President Sisi. So it's become a magnet for groups of that nature. I think it will remain under within some limits. I don't think the Muslim Brotherhood in general or the Egyptian public is in a mood of widespread insurgency. So I don't think we're looking at something like Iraq or Syria or Afghanistan or things of that nature, but it will remain as a threat.
What do you see are Sisi's biggest challenges henceforth?
The main challenge, really, that is measurable and that most Egyptians care deeply about, aside from the political controversy of inclusion and rights and so on, the other side of the equation is the economy. Now, he said from the beginning that he's going to focus on security, stability, and he said, I want to get results in the economy because that's what most Egyptians want. And indeed, I think that's true. 50% of Egyptians are now under the poverty line of income of $2 a day, and that's a massive number, and it's getting bigger. And his wager was, as well as his supporters from the Gulf, that by buying a couple of years of stability and sort of a big mandate, which maybe he won't be getting, they could focus on quick investments and an attempt to turn the economy quickly around to give sort of momentum and give sort of new hope for many Egyptians. It's going to be more difficult now if he doesn't get a large-scale mandate. There will be more focus on the politics because the politics will be unresolved and he will not be as free as he hoped he would be simply to focus on economic issues.
Could the next parliamentary election serve as a culmination of the roadmap that would justify restoring U.S. aid to Egypt?
Well, U.S. aid, I mean, a lot of it has continued. There's tranches of it that are still in suspension. I think the U.S. administration is eager to resume cooperation with the Egyptian military for the reasons that President Obama indicated, for security reasons, Gaza and the Sinai and anti-terror and Israel. The U.S. administration has serious concerns about the political situation in Egypt, and the White House is a political institution, so it's very impacted by public opinion, and Congress is also very much impacted. So both Congress and the administration are trying to balance the clear strategic interests with concerns of public opinion and the difficult political process in Egypt. The parliamentary elections are an opportunity. Now, how they will be approached, if Sisi, you know, as president, will open up political space and allow the parliamentary elections to be a doorway to bring back groups and parties, including the youth, the Sabahi, you know, obviously the Salafists, and some of the ex-Muslim Brotherhoods, maybe they can form a new party and enter afresh into the political sphere. That might be a way to bring back more inclusive politics to parliament. After parliamentary elections, and depending on the results of those elections, a President Sisi could then form a political cabinet which would represent many of these groups and allow them to feel that, well, they're represented in the new system, that they have a say, that there is more a return to kind of more inclusive politics in Egypt. I think that would help relieve the political tension in the country and allow other members of the government to focus on economic matters.
And lastly, Paul Salem, your thoughts about going forward in Egypt, notwithstanding some of the problems with this election, low turnout. Is this some sort of a turning point? Are you relatively optimistic that these many challenges, economic, security, and in terms of the polarization in civil society can be overcome? Do you see Egypt being on the right track?
Well, I take the long view, and when you look at transitions in other parts of the world, they take a long time. It took about 200 years in the West. I mean, between the decline of monarchies from the 18th century all the way to World War I. And only after World War II did the West really stabilize into sort of democracy and stability. I hope that obviously in the Arab world things won't take that long, but it really is a complicated and long process. I think Egyptians are learning from what happened over the 3 years. A, they've learned that they have a voice and that they can act. They can revolt, they can vote, they cannot vote, they can protest, and that is something they will not rescind. You know, they voted for the Muslim Brotherhood, then they regretted it. Took them a while to learn that. They welcomed sort of the military to remove the Muslim Brotherhood. Now I think they're having second thoughts about military governing them. I think the Muslim Brotherhood itself learned a lot from their experiences, and as we were saying, they need to rethink. And I think the military, who may have thought that this is easy, we'll just do it, you know, like we always used to, will also have to learn that governing large, empowered societies in the 21st century is more complicated than it used to be. Militaries in Turkey and Spain, it took them a couple decades to learn that too. But I think, and I hope, that Egypt is on a learning curve. What I worry about, because of the dire economic situation, Egyptians might not have all that time to learn because the economy is already on the brink of much more serious decline. And if it gets much worse, Egypt as a society might no longer be governable in general. If poverty really reaches even more massive proportions, it might begin to break down as a governable society, and then it will be very problematic.
Paul Salem is Vice President of the Middle East Institute. That's a prominent think tank based here in Washington. Paul, thank you very much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Sharing your terrific insights about Egypt and its future. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Joining me on the program was VOA Senior Reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Zubair Al-Tayyib. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.